End am I supposed to use to point with?
Okay.
Thank you. Yes, this is the title I gave you, but I realized as I was going through my slides last night, it was a bit too self-promotional. So the talk is a bit more than just an advert for my latest model. It's so this is maybe a better title than what I should have given you. So I'll give you an overview of some non-standard dark matter models and how you go about looking for them in direct detection. And as I say, this is work I did with postdoc at Fermilab, Yang Bai. He's moving off to SLAC soon, or end of the year. Okay, so this is the outline. I will give you a review about dark matter, which I'm sure you don't need, but I'll briefly start to shake. Yeah, you're right. And, either that or I'm really nervous. So, and then I'll tell you about some direct dark matter, direct detection experiments of dark matter, and I'll focus in on one of them. The one that only the one with the biggest claim for having perhaps seen something, and then I'll review some of the models that can try to explain Dharma without being in conflict with the other null experiments, and then I'll focus in on one particular solution, which is this resin dark matter, and I'll walk you through that and then conclude. Okay, so can't quite see the line here, but as you well know, there's this lovely measurement of the CMB. And there's now lots of evidence out there that there really is something, some non-baryonic component to the matter energy budget of the universe, makes up sort of 25% of the matter that's out there. We can see this from, as I said, from the CMB or various other observables. And there are many things we now know, or various things we now know fairly well about the dark matter that we didn't say it's about 10 years ago. For instance, we now know its cosmological abundance, as I said, it's about 20% or so. Oops. And as we get from the CMB. And we also know that, roughly speaking, there's a, you know, perhaps a factor of, a factor of two variation in exactly what this number is. It could be, say, as small as 0.1 or as big as 0.7. But roughly speaking, we know what the local abundance in our galaxy or in our neighborhood of our galaxy for this dark matter, we know it's about 0.3 GeV per centimeter cubed. So we know various things about the dark matter, but we don't really know exactly what it is or how it interacts with the standard model. And just because I think it's a great picture, here's another thing we know about the dark matter that really doesn't interact very much with the other things. As of course, this is not the best measurement of this, but it's certainly the prettiest. So I'll just flash that picture. Some other things we know about dark matter, or actually, we don't really know these things about dark matter, but some of the assumptions we make about dark matter that it has a certain velocity distribution. It's sitting in a cloud, and we're sitting inside this big halo of dark matter, and the dark matter particles are moving around with some characteristic velocity, characteristic speed, rather, and we assume, for the most part, in almost all analyses that are done, that the dark matter is sitting in a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution with a characteristic velocity of around 220 kilometers per second, and, of course, there's some escape velocity beyond which the dark matter would have evaporated away from our galaxy and would no longer be bound. And again, you can argue over exactly what this escape velocity is, but it's typically taken to be somewhere at, say, 500 to 600 kilometers a second. And you can also spend some time arguing over what the density profile of dark matter is. We know, as I said, we know approximately how much there is in our neighborhood, but we really know very little about how to extrapolate, say, into the inner core of our galaxy. So there are various models out there. They all have roughly the same feature at large radii, but at the inner core, they all differ wildly with one another. So there are various things we know, and there are various things we don't know. And that's a good state to be in, because it means we can make predictions and test them and learn some stuff about what this dark matter is. So how do you go about... So here is the way you go about finding dark matter and directly probing it and finding how it couples with standard model. You draw a giant Feynman diagram like this, and then you go with it from there, you run. So the question is, what's in this blob? And of course, everybody's model has a different way in which the standard model talks to the dark matter and a different way in which it shows up in direct detection. But there are a few sort of ballpark figures that it's nice to be aware of when you start to get involved in this game. So roughly speaking, the dark matter is around 100 GeV or so. There are various reasons to want this. You know, there's motivation for many beyond the standard model scenarios such as SUSY and things like that, where there are natural candidates for the WIMP. There are always these R parity odd states, and the lightest one has many of the right characteristics to be a dark matter candidate. And so there's some input into this number, but there are roughly speaking, 10 to hundreds of GeV is sort of the number you should keep at the back of your mind for the dark matter mass. And so using this and knowing that making the assumption that it sits in this Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, you have an idea as to how much momentum one of these guys is coming into your detector with, and it's order 100 MeV. And from that, you can quickly calculate, if it does bounce off some nucleus in your detector, roughly speaking, how much energy does it leave behind for you to go and look at? And it's hundreds of keV or thereabouts. So those are the numbers. Those are the numbers you should be thinking about. So you're talking about depositing 100 keV of energy. And the next question you should ask yourself is, how often does it do this? And again, taking some coming into this with some preconceived ideas. So we have this 0.3 number. We're thinking of this as hundreds of GeV. And then we have some idea as to roughly what this cross-section should be if we make the additional assumption that the dark matter is a thermal relic. So its abundance, the present-day abundance is predicted by some heavy state freezing out in the early universe. And the cross-section required to get the abundance right is this picoban number. And putting all these things in here, you find that you get, roughly speaking, one event per day per kilogram of stuff in your lab, leaving this amount of energy behind. And so this is a pretty small rate. This should be compared, say, for instance, to the rate you get from sort of cosmic ray events, which is hundreds of events per day per kilogram in this energy range. So these are tough experiments to do. You have to sit there with basically a big lump of stuff for a long time, and your big lump of stuff has to be very highly instrumented to pick out these small deposits of energy. And so the big question is, how do you go about distinguishing this, as I say, a small number of events, of signal events of this type from potentially many, many other background events? So as you know, there are a whole lot of experiments. Oh, this projector's washing out a whole lot of the plots. Well, never mind. It'll just make the plots later on even harder to see. So anyway, so there are these direct detection experiments. They go about trying, they've set themselves this goal of trying to distinguish this one event per day per kilo from these hundreds of events per day of background, or potentially hundreds of events per day. So the first thing you have to do is try and lower that background number as much as possible. And there are various approaches to doing that. You can try to get rid of as many of these cosmic ray backgrounds, which are the dominant source of background initially, by going as deep underground as you can afford to. That gets rid of a lot of the cosmic rays. Then you can try to shield your equipment from any radioactive backgrounds that might be lying around that would also leave a similar signal to a radioactive decay, can send in a gamma or a beta or something and smack into your atom and shake it around in much the same way as a dark matter particle coming in and hitting the nucleus. So you'd like to get rid of that by shielding. Again, if you cool the equipment, then you get rid of a lot of the thermal noise, and that can help. And finally, what you do is you try to take as many measurements as possible, and hopefully there's some features of the, say you can measure ionization and scintillation or the phonons that are excited in the crystal lattice. You can try to measure all these things and hope that a dark matter collision, which would be a dark matter particle coming in and typically scattering off the nucleus of an atom, would be very different from these background events. And typically these backgrounds, if they're, say, from radioactivity, they're due to photons coming in and scattering off electrons in the atom. So you can try to distinguish between these two types of events by how they show up in, so let's look at this plot, maybe this is easier. So this is on the vertical axis here is the ratio of two of these observables, it's ionization and scintillation. And for the life of me, I don't remember which is which now, but it's the ratio of either ionization over scintillation or the other way up. And as a function of the recoil energy. And what you can see here is there's a whole load of events up here in this. These are the background type events where there's many of them. And so they make this cut. This is the xenon experiment, xenon 10. They make this cut, but this ratio has to lie in some window here. And this is where they expect there to be very, very few background events, because typically backgrounds end up giving you more ionization and scintillation and signals the other way around. And CDMS does something similar here by looking at the ionization versus the phonon signal. And again, you have, let me get this the right way, you have electron type events, either in the bulk or on the surface, and then you have nuclear recoils, and they lie in different places in this plane. By making cuts, you can try to limit the number of background events. So that's typically how some of these experiments are done. But of course, there's another way you can do it, which is to look for what's called annual modulation. And so this is this goes back, I guess, to Galileo was the first person to, or Copernicus or somebody, was the first person to come up with this way of searching for dark matter. by noticing that the Earth moves around the Sun, and the Sun moves around the center of the galaxy. What this means is at different times of the year, the Earth speed relative to the galactic frame is different because the motions add up or subtract.
Can you elaborate that
Kepler?
I think he means Kepler.
No, I guess I mean Copernicus, right? I want the Earth to be orbiting around the Sun, not the Sun to be orbiting around the Earth. Yeah. That's right. Although, of course, he didn't have the sense to think about using Germanium detectors or anything like that.
Yeah.
But you know, you can't.
The Greeks thought about that too, right? Because that was the argument against it when they brought it up, that they said that, well, if we're moving around the Sun, then we'd see parallax.
Oh, so
yeah,
and they I've done some Greek philosopher a bad service. what's that? There we go. So the idea here is that in the galactic frame, this which what I was telling you a couple of minutes ago, there is this velocity distribution for the dark matter, or at least this is what we think, approximately speaking, the dark matter speeds are distributed like. But we do our experiments not in the galactic frame, but in the Earth's frame, and as I said, the Earth's motion either adds or subtracts to the Sun's motion. And giving you a velocity distribution in the Earth's frame, which is, of course, what we're going to observe, that looks something like this. And so here you see the Earth's velocity entering into the distribution. And you can sit down and work out, or people have by making various observations, have worked out exactly what the Earth's velocity is in the galactic frame. And as you'd expect, it's modulated on a yearly basis. So there's some overall speed, and then of the Sun, and then there's our motion around the Sun. It ends up giving you a distribution, say, in the, let me get my colors the right way around. So in the winter, the velocity distribution that we observe or could observe for the dark matter is this blue curve, and in the summer, it shifted to higher velocities, because in the summer, our motion happens to add up, at least happens to add up to the add to the Sun's velocity and give you a slightly higher average speed. And so the hope is if you could look for this modulation effect in detectors rather than trying to separate signal from background, you would say, well, dark matter would be the only thing that would modulate in this way. Background shouldn't, and that would allow you another way to distinguish background events from dark matter events. So there are, as I said, there are several interesting numbers. You can work out roughly what this modulation is, and it's only a few percent or so. And the other important number to take off this slide is June 2nd. So this is the date at which the Earth's speed adds maximally to the Sun's speed around the galaxy. So this is when you'd expect the highest possible velocity dark matter events to, or highest possible speed for the dark matter particles in your detector. So DARMA, which is an experiment in Italy, does exactly this. It goes out, or stays still, actually, it doesn't go out. It looks for to see if it has any modulation in the number of events in their crystals. And they don't try to distinguish background events from signal events. They just try to measure all dark matter-like events, so all nuclear recalls, in other words. And then they look to see if there's any time variation in the number of nuclear recalls they observe. And they would try to attribute that modulation to this modulation due to the Earth's motion. So they do just that. And in fact, you can't see their data points because it's all washed out. But I assure you there are plenty of data points on this plot. And I think the old DARMA, DARMA NAI, the data points are quite... And you have to have a good eye to sort of convince yourself there really is this a clear signal for an oscillation. But DARMA Libra, which was a bigger experiment and upgraded in various other ways, the data points do really, it's terrible, you can't see them. If you believe me, that's okay. So,
we've seen the plot.
You've seen the plot many times. Yeah, they still don't show up. I don't know what's going on. Anyway. So,
because it's not there.
reality
has set in, that's right.
it's
a very special, it's not a two-way mirror, it's a real... Very good. So this number here is completely made up. You should know. So the point is that there is this oscillation, and they see this oscillation at 8.2 sigma. So there really is some type of oscillation going on. But most amazing to me is that the peak of the oscillation, which is here, although of course you can't see that the data agrees with that, but certainly you can see the sine curve has peaked there, lies pretty much on June 2nd. It's sort of plus or minus a week or so, or a little less than a week, in fact. But
do you mean you average over
What's the error? What's the error on the maximum?
Error on the maximum is, I think, 3 or 4 days, plus or minus 3 or 4 days.
Average over
all? No, cannot.
Yeah, I think it is.
Not in the real world, but in their data sets. Mm-hmm. Is that what they're saying?
I think maybe it's 5 days or something, but it's order a week. Yeah.
When is the summer solstice?
July or June 22nd, like, or 21st, I never remember.
What's that? When
the longest day. Longest day of the year.
June
22nd.
So that's not that far.
No, it's not that far, that's right.
I think that period is July 2nd.
So. Yeah, much better than the month.
Oh, much better than a month. Yeah, much better. That's right. I don't know whether it's 5 days or 7 days or 4 days, but it's much better than a month. So they've seen this again and again over many years, and it always seems to line up. You know, we can go and look back and see exactly what they say in their paper, but so what they're observing here, so the way you parameterize the signal is there's some constant piece and then some modulation piece, and there's an amplitude, and then there's a phase associated with it. And the phase they're finding is that agrees with the June 2nd phase you'd expect from the Earth's motion. And it's modulated on a yearly basis as well. But as you were just pointing out, the big question is, does annual modulation, is that equivalent to discovering dark matter? But there are many things that modulate on a yearly timescale. I mean, this thing is underground in the lab, and they do regulate the temperature of their apparatus, but there are many external environmental effects. Temperature certainly varies on a yearly timescale. The amount of water that's stuck in the hill above them, they're buried underground, and the amount of water absorbed in the soil varies. Radon abundances, the amount of radon in all these things vary on a yearly timescale. Some of them obviously shouldn't affect the signal, but you don't know about the others. I mean, they've done very, very careful analyses, they claim, to monitor many of these backgrounds and check that they don't explain the signal they're seeing, but there could be some unknown systematic or something that is feeding into this. But in the moment, the way I like to think of it is that the fact that it lines up with June 2nd is probably a very strong reason to keep thinking about it. And as we'll see, one interesting thing that comes about from thinking of Dharma, whether you really believe this data or not, is if you do try to explain it, you're led sort of away from the conventional description of dark matter as a sort of a Susie Wimp or something like it. And you're led down into various different scenarios that weren't really explored, haven't been fully explored so far. And they have, many of them have different signals at other dark matter detectors. And I think without the motivation of Dharma, people wouldn't have explored those possibilities. And so it's good to explore these possibilities to make sure we're not missing a non-standard dark matter candidate at other experiments.
Why wouldn't they find a nice location in South Carolina just move the apparatus there? What's to gain in grants as office?
You mean why aren't they doing that?
Yeah.
I think there was a proposal to do that, and I've heard stories about there was a proposal for, I don't remember where in South America, to put the thing, but the PI of that experiment died or something like that. So that's one story. But it's true. You could move it to the southern hemisphere, and then of course it should still peak at June 2nd. But June 2nd is now the middle of winter in the southern hemisphere, and so if there is some environmental effect, it should be out of phase, and you should be able to distinguish. But it is a worthwhile thing to do. It would also be good if somebody repeated the experiment, somewhere in the northern hemisphere, away from Sudan, from Gran Sasso.
Is there some issue that you can't get the crystal or something?
There is some fishy business with that, that's right. I am being recorded, so I can't tell you exactly what I would think, but there are some dysfunctional features, I should say, about the experiment, but it is unfortunate, yeah. And there was even a proposal to take a Dharma sodium iodide crystal and put it into one of the neutrino experiments, put it in the middle of the tank. And they're very, very well, they're, you know, very, very low background. And they'll be able to measure the background within the crystal itself very, very well over a short period of time. I think, unfortunately, it would kill their experiment. It would have to be done at the end because it would essentially contaminate their experiment. I don't remember which neutrino experiment it was now. So there are that met with resistance for the reasons you're talking about. So again, on this plot, oh, maybe they haven't come in yet. Oh, that's good. I was worried that everything was being washed out. Okay, so why do I say that Dharma has this result, and I kept alluding to the fact that they're in conflict with other experiments without actually telling you why they're in conflict. So here is the typical way in which WIMP searches present their results. There is the assumed WIMP mass here on the horizontal, and then on the vertical is the cross-section normalized to nucleons. So this is the interaction cross-section of a dark matter particle off a nucleon in a nucleus. And these curves are for various experiments. So below the curve is allowed. So these are exclusion curves from, say, CDMS or KIMS or xenon and other things like it. And there are various things to notice about these curves. So, oops, I hope you can read quickly. So there are various things to notice. They all have pretty much the same shape, and this is just determined by the fact that the rate goes like the number density of dark matter particles, which scales like 1 over their mass, because we know that the mass density is 0.3 per GeV cubed. So you make the mass very large, there are very few of them around, and so you don't get as good a band. And then over here, they're all shooting off very quickly because there are various thresholds. You can't go too low in recoil energy without running into some background you can't get rid of. And so at some point, your experimental sensitivity turns off. And as you go lower in WIMP mass, the amount of energy you deposit in a collision gets lower, and you get closer and closer to these thresholds. So that's why they're all turning off over here. And now I'm worried that there should be a nice pink region. Actually, if I can get it right, it's shaped a bit like a hockey stick. So there's a pink region right there that is the Dharma region. That's what would be consistent with what Dharma sees. So that would be they would need a mass that sits in that window with a cross section. It sits in that region. And as you can see, that's already ruled out by various iterations of these experiments. So that's the tension. If you want to try and explain Dharma, if you really think they are seeing dark matter, they can't be seeing just a normal WIMP because that seems to already be excluded by CDMS and others. And there are a couple of other comments to make about this plot. What we really mean by a WIMP, depending on who exactly you ask, you can wonder what the weak in weakly interacting means. And if it really means weak scale, as in MW and MZ, then all these experiments have really ruled out WIMPs as they're historically defined, because you find that the cross section in these units is about 10 to the minus 35, 10 to the minus 36 centimeters squared, and that's way up here somewhere. And these experiments already rule out the simple WIMP. So it already tells you that WIMP is perhaps a bad name for these creatures, whatever they are. Yes?
A couple of days ago, I stumbled upon a paper, new measurements which say that the velocity of the solar system around the galactic center is actually more towards 250 kilometers per second.
Is this some Swedish collaboration, or is this, I'm thinking of the wrong people?
First off, is me.
Okay, I don't know this one. So it's moved up to 250?
So I wonder what happens to the exclusion limits when they go down.
That's a good question. So that would generally push the velocity up a little bit, it sounds like. And so that would, I guess that would improve the bound slightly, yes, because now things would be coming in with more speed, they'd be depositing more energy, and it would make.
I remember a paper about a year ago that actually did add this stuff first, had most velocities 200 and there was
very little. So at the end of the day, it gets somewhat washed out by the fact that we don't really know what the velocity distribution of the dark matter is, and you're averaging over that, and then your escape velocity will be different from my escape velocity, and things become very... It becomes a little unfortunate that these things enter into the analysis. It'd be nice if you could do some sort of model-independent thing where you don't have to make the assumption of dark matter velocity distributions and things like that, but that's not been done yet. But it's true. If our speed had suddenly gone up by a factor of 2, then it would make these plans a lot stronger. No, but you're talking about a 10%, 5% change? Yeah? Actually, maybe you can tell me afterwards what that paper is. I'd like to read that. Okay, so there are various. This is great. Luckily, I had anticipated this one. Now at least you can see the points. You can't see the axes. So there are various explanations for there are various possible explanations out there for how you can have a dark matter candidate at the same time could predict events in Dharma without being in conflict with the other null experiments. There are various. I'll describe some of these in more detail in the following slides. But there's a possibility that dark matter is very light, around 10 GeV or so, and then there's this funny effect that happens in crystal lattice, in particular in the sodium iodide lattice. There can be this effect of channeling, where if you happen to come in and hit a nucleus in just the right direction, the energy gets out of the crystal without being depleted in any way. Usually, there's what's called a quench factor, where the event you see is at far lower energy than the event that actually happened. But there's possibility that some small fraction of events don't suffer this suppression in the observed energy, and that could explain. But this channeling is very poorly understood, and I think there are a lot more measurements need to be done to exactly understand this channeling effect to see if this possibility survives. There's a possibility that you scatter off the electrons and not off the nucleus in an atom. This probably is not so. The scenario is not so optimistic these days. People have reanalyzed it and it doesn't quite work as well. There's the possibility of inelastic dark matter, which I'll explain in more detail as I will for form factor and resonance. So let me just press on. But those are some other candidates that are non-standard in the way the dark matter behaves that allow the possibility that you can see the signal in Dharma without being in conflict with, say, CDMS. So what I mean by the signal, as I said earlier, that you can take the observed number of events and you can package it into a flat piece, flat in time, and a modulating piece, and you have to get the amplitude of the modulation. But you can similarly look at the spectrum in energy, and so here is the from the x-axis here you can't see is KeV, and the y-axis is this S0, and over here it's SM with the KeV on the x-axis. And so you can see that there's at least in the unmodulated piece, there's a spectrum that you would expect that all the events are clumped down at low energies. But you can see that there is not very many features. And then in the modulated spectrum, you'd also, for a standard WIMP, you would expect an exponentially growing into the infrared. You'd expect an exponentially growing spectrum. And there's this funny first bin that appears to be off the exponential by quite a lot. And a fair amount has been made of that. It does seem a little bit strange. But those are the spectra you will be trying to explain if you explain Dharma. And at the same time, you would expect no events, or try to explain no events of CDMS, or no more than two. Sorry?
Why does lepto help?
Oh, sorry, yes, I didn't explain that. So that helps because if you suppose you have a dark matter that only couples to electrons, and it comes in and it smacks into an electron, so then that looks like a background event as far as CDMS is concerned. Because it looks like, say, a gamma coming in and hitting an electron, and they veto against those by these ratios of various cuts and what have you. But Dharma doesn't. Dharma just takes every event they have and looks for a modulation. And so in that sense, Dharma's analysis is what they call model independent, and the others are not.
Can other experiments do the same thing, take every event and look for a modulation?
They can, and they're starting to. That's right. So CDMS has actually done something like that analysis just recently. But initially they weren't, because they wanted to. As you can see, I mean, this S0 contains a lot of background as well. Yeah. The modulation is only a few percent.
So they published a null result on modulation, or are they just starting to?
They published. I'm trying to remember the conclusion of their paper. So they analyzed Dharma's result and tried to extract from Dharma's published data Dharma's background. Which is a very strange thing for one experiment to try and extract the other experiment's background, because they were looking themselves for a modulation. And they of course have nowhere near as much data, right? Dharma is a huge, great experiment. I don't know. I didn't draw attention to the number. Oh, too many button presses. So if you look here, that you're talking basically about a ton year, right? And you're talking about hundreds of kilo days at the other experiments. So they have a lot more exposure than the other experiments. It's a lot harder to do at CDMS, but they are trying. I mean, you could also hope that Dharma would try to estimate their background and so on and so forth. That's not the way they've done it.
So CDMS is doing an analysis where they assume M is true and they try to figure out basically
they tried to
should see their model.
Yeah, exactly. They said, let's imagine this really is what Dharma sees. What would they expect to see in all events without cutting away the lepton light, the background like events?
Yeah.
And they claim to have not seen what would be expected.
So they should have seen it.
But I'm, it's not clear to me that it's not clear to me they did the analysis perfectly. Okay. So as I said, this is the one important slide, but really that's because it's got all the formulae on it, and I want you to stay awake. So that's why I call it the important slide. But it can be a little bit scary when you see all these the equations on one slide. But this is it. This is the master formula. This explains all of direct detection. So this is the spectrum for the rate as a function of recoil energy that you would expect to see in your detector. And let me explain the various pieces that entered into this formula. So there are a whole lot of numbers out front that you're not allowed to argue about. You know, there's Avogadro's number, there's the mass of the nucleus, the mass of the dark matter. Well, once you tell me what you think the mass of the dark matter is, that's not up for debate. There's the density of the dark matter, which is roughly this 0.3 number. We could argue maybe it's 0.4, but basically this isn't really up to debate. And then there are the bits that you can play with as a particle theorist. So what you have to do to get the rate is you have to take the cross section and weight it by the velocity distribution, integrate over the velocity distribution I'll explain what these are. But basically you have to do this integral, and that will determine for you as a function of the recoil energy how many events you expect to see. As I said, everything in black here is pretty much fixed. And then there are the bits you can play with. So typically, what happens is you have to work out the scattering cross-section, and somebody hands you a microscopic Lagrangian. You say, oh, maybe my dark matter couples to the Higgs, maybe it couples to the Z, but I know how those objects couple to the neutron and the proton, so therefore I can work out the scattering cross-section on the nucleus. I can relate it to the scattering cross-section of dark matter on a proton, and it's related in this way. And then I can put that in this equation, and I can do, as you notice, this is just a number at the end of the day. There's no velocity dependence in here in the usual situation. And so this is just can be pulled out of the integral. Then there's the question about what your limits of integration are. This really isn't up for debate, remember. Once you've made this assumption it's Maxwell-Boltzmann, you can argue a little bit about V0, the characteristic speed, and you can argue a little bit about the escape velocity, but not much more than that. So then, suppose you have some number of events and you say, well, my detector works down to, say, a few keV. So that determines for you the minimum velocity that your dark matter has to come in with such that the recoil is at least a few keV or bigger. Because if I have too small of a velocity, I can't deposit enough energy in the apparatus to be observed. So that's why this integral is cut off not at zero, but at what I call Vmin. And the Vmin is determined simply by the non-relativistic kinematics. If you tell me the energy you're interested in, I can determine for you what speed my dark matter has to have, the minimum speed it can have. Of course, it could have a higher speed and just have a glancing blow and deposit the same amount of energy. But if it deposits all the energy it can, there is some minimum velocity. And then there's some maximum velocity that's probably determined by the escape velocity. That's as far high up as you can go. And then finally, there is, in going from the scattering on a quark or a nucleon up to the scattering on a nucleus, you have to take into account some form factors. Actually, you have to take into account the form factors because you're doing this at q squared not equal to zero. And for the, at least for the nuclear form factors, these are well known. You can look them up in some textbooks and calculate this. But there is also the possibility that there is some other form factor in the game. Maybe as well as the nucleus having a form factor, perhaps the dark matter has a form factor. Perhaps the dark matter is composite. So you could argue about the exact shape and form of this form factor.
Isn't there a velocity dependence somewhere? Just the recoil velocity?
Yes, so really the rate is given by sigma v times, and so this sigma v is in here, and when you end up doing the calculation, you end up with a 1 over v down here. I could go through it if you want, but...
that sigma depends on energy. The whole energy depends on that e.
In principle it can. Suppose you're exchanging an incredibly light state, then you would have a 1 over q squared plus m light state squared. But typically, the usual story is you're exchanging, say, a Z, and then the Q squared is so tiny that this is just 1 over MZ squared, this cross section. So this is just a number at the end of the day. Now, the story I'm going to tell you about in a moment is exactly what you're getting at, that there will be some velocity dependence, and we'll see that changes the story entirely. But for the moment, this is exactly what everything here on the slide is what you would need to extract those bounds, and you would just need to sit down with your SUSY model, your little Higgs model, whatever it is, and get this number. Put this number in and you're done. So the reason I'm a model builder, so I like to look for dials to play with, and so here's the formula that you use, and the only dials that are really are the three you can play with are these three here. No, that's an astrophysicist would play with that, but not a field theorist. I take their word that they believe it's Maxwell-Boltzmann. Okay, so then people have explored these possibilities. So let me talk about inelastic dark matter. This is originally written down by Neil Winer and David Tucker Smith some number of years ago now. And they play with the bit in blue. So they play with the V-min. And the way in which they do that is they change the story slightly, that instead of dark matter scattering off a nucleus and outcoming dark matter, they imagine that there's another nearby state, a cousin of dark matter, that's different in slightly in mass, and the scattering is inelastic. And when you do this, so imagine the splitting between the two states is delta, and it has to be of this size to be relevant, then what you find is, because you have to upscatter in the process of colliding off the nucleus, it changes exactly what the minimum velocity is. Clearly, you have to come in now with more velocity because you can't just scatter off something. You have to leave some of your energy behind to get up in mass. So that raises the minimum velocity and changes in this way. You're hearing this is the splitting. So now the lower limit of the integration changes, and this has various phenomenological effects. So as I said, it requires larger momentum transfer to do the upscattering. As a result, you get pushed out to the high velocity tail of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, and this will increase the amount of modulation you see at your experiment. If you can remember the two curves, as you go further and further to the right, they become more and more discrepant with one another. In fact, you can imagine the extreme case where the splitting is such that in the winter, there are no particles with enough velocity to upscatter, and only in the summer do you have enough velocity, because this splitting is tuned to be in that small, and then you get the maximum amount of modulation possible. And in addition, if you stare at this formula for long enough, you can convince yourself that it prefers heavy targets, or of course you know intuitively that if you throw a bowling ball through a bunch of ping pong balls, this is the famous story, nothing happens. If you throw a bowling ball through bowling balls, then you get big collisions. And so if you need a big collision because of the splitting, you would prefer to have heavier elements in your detector. And so it favors experiments that have heavy elements, and it turns out, if you go and look at the periodic table, that germanium isn't really that heavy of an element, and that's what basically makes up most of CDMS, but iodine is a heavy element. And so this is why this has the possibility to explain Dharma without being a... and there are people in this room far more qualified than myself to tell you further details about the upscatter and the potential downscatter, because it turns out that these can still be around, left over from the thermal history of the universe, and you could have the reverse process, which then leaves a bunch of energy in the detector and has some interesting features. So that's one way, that's one of the three possibilities. Oops, there you go. And there's another way called form factor dark matter, or momentum dependent dark matter, depending on which group of authors you talk to. And the story here is just in the way that the nucleus has a form factor, perhaps the dark matter has a form factor. So the coupling, this is the, suppose you exchange some light state, if the dark matter is composite in some way, or the coupling has some momentum dependence. Yes.
So in the previous scenario, usually you say you have like a few percent modulation.
That's right.
And now you're going to increase that.
That's right. You can increase it up to 100%. You can go all the way.
But the thing is that if you go up to 100 or close to 100%, then it's not going to be sinusoidal anymore, because you don't have the first step in the expansion.
So yes, you can ask about, you would have, it would be what you call a Fourier thing. I mean, you can, yeah. They've only extracted the amplitude of the sine piece. So then you have to sit down and think, if it so only turned on
now,
for, yeah, you would have.
Are there constraints on like higher order?
I don't think they've extracted, I think, There is something in the Dharma paper, and I don't remember it now off the top of my head, about how if there's any power in any other frequency.
Yeah. So I imagine that would put a constraint on.
But if you push it very hard, you're right. You could have it so it only is turned on for very like a week around June 2nd or something.
Exactly.
But alternatively, you could, before you get to that extreme, you're just dialing up the amplitude of the modulating piece. You could still have it be observed all throughout the entire year because there is some overlap of the Maxwell-Boltzmann in the winter with the what's required to get the right scatter, to get enough energy deposited. But it just would dial up the amplitude of that piece. And that's a good thing to do because typically, if you have only, you couldn't see it, unfortunately. Those two plots that were down at the bottom, you can't see it at all. You'd have to take my word for it. Actually, maybe. So what you find is if you remember what the curve looked like, you're talking about this is the number of counts per day. And so if you take this and you work out how much modulation you'd expect, just assuming that it was 250 or 220 kilometers a second, you'd find it's about 6%. So you would take this and you'd multiply by or divide by 0.06, and that would tell you how big you'd expect this to be. And then what you find if you take this number and do that, you get very dangerously close to the number of to the point that was on this plot. So what that means is there's almost no room for background in this S0. So this if this really is a 6% modulation, then the unmodulated event rate seems to be almost saturated by the dark matter signal. And that's bad because we know they haven't cut out their background. So it means that now, it's not quite a disaster, but it means you're getting dangerously close to just if you take a normal wind that doesn't increase its modulation, you're in a dangerous place. Now, so that's why a model such as inelastic, which increases the modulation, is on safer ground. Did that make sense? That was a bit fast.
Well, if you go on, then maybe.
Yeah, okay. I have to go on, otherwise I'll never get finished. Then there's the possibility of momentum-dependent dark matter. As I said, you can have a form factor here, so why not a form factor there? And then if you can arrange for this form factor through some clever model-building tricks, if you can arrange for this form factor to have a particular shape in momentum space, then you can look at the what momentum exchanges are being probed by the various experiments. So again, I apologize, this plot isn't showing up, but there's Q along the x-axis, and this is the range of Q that's being probed by Dharma. We don't really care about the numbers, or they would have shown up, but you can see what the other experiments are probing. So you see there is always an overlap with at least one experiment, but you see the other experiments end up probing different ranges. So if you could arrange for your form factor to be peaked mainly in here and to be roughly turned off outside, then of course Dharma will be more sensitive to dark matter than the other experiments. And this, again, has various implications, but this is one way in which you could boost the signal at Dharma without coming into conflict with, say, CDMS. And that's done by playing with the green bit. And that brings me finally to Yang and myself, where we looked at the formula and we said, what else is left to play with? And there's the red bit left to play with, and so let's play with it. So we imagine the situation, which is what you were alluding to, that this cross-section is actually velocity-dependent. And then, in particular, what we imagined is that it has a very particular type of velocity dependence. And I'll show you how this happens very simply in a very simple model in a couple of slides. But we imagined that the dependence was of a resonant type. So there's some sort of resonant behavior in the velocity. And what this does for you is it takes the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution that you would usually integrate over. So you would integrate over from some V min all the way out to V max. Now, if this has some resonant type structure, then it basically picks out, roughly speaking, one particular velocity or some narrow range of velocities out of the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution. And as you can see, this increases the modulation because clearly the area under the curve is the same in the summer or winter. So if you integrate over the whole curve, there's no difference. But if you only integrate over a narrow range now where they are discrepant, you can increase the amount of modulation. And as we'll see, a particular very simple realization of this idea ends up giving us a cross-section which is highly element-dependent, which will be a sort of unique and somewhat beneficial feature. So that was the last piece left to play with, and so let's just, and that's what I'll spend the rest of the time talking about. So this is just what I said. If the cross-section had this particular structure, And I'll, trust me, I'll explain to you how this can happen very simply in a couple of slides. But if we just believe me for now, that it has this sort of resonant, you know, there's some resonant speed and some width, then you can end up, as I said, picking out a particular velocity. And if you look at the percentage of modulation as a function of where that resonance is, and these curves are for different choices of the width of the resonance, you can see that you can clearly, you can easily make the modulation very, very large. And this helps, again, with this issue between the unmodulated signal and the modulated signal at Dharma. So perhaps you should ask a question again if I didn't explain it well enough from the previous slide.
You're saying there's an issue. I still don't understand what is the issue.
Okay, so roughly speaking, the number of counts in the modulated signal, say, is 0.02, and the number of counts at the same energy in the unmodulated signal is roughly 1. Mm-hmm. Now, if you have 6% modulation, which is what you'd expect for or maybe it's even 3%, maybe I've got my numbers wrong, but somewhere of a few percent like that, then you would, that tells you, given the modulated signal, how many you expect an unmodulated. And you see you get dangerously close, because 0.02 divided by 0.06 is like a third.
So the larger is the modulation, then this is the problem, like you have 30% modulation.
So if you had 30% modulation, you'd take 0.02 and divide it by 0.3, and then you would have far fewer expected dark matter unmodulated events.
So
that's good, because you know you have to have room for background.
But then the problem with that is that you expect the second harmonic to be there.
Yes, you would expect higher harmonics, that's right.
At the level of 10%,
0.3.
That's right. That's right. If gamma doesn't see that, then that is a problem. So I'm just wondering if anybody is.
Yeah, so people, we can go and look at their paper. They do one of these Fourier analyses, but I don't think.
In the talk by gamma
versus. Yeah, I don't think.
I think they do the Fourier analysis.
But it's not clear to me they have enough distinguishing power to see something as small as what he's describing.
10%.
Yeah, we can look afterwards, but it's not. I mean, because then, if you get high enough, you could start to see a weekly modulation or a daily modulation, and those are things they don't have the discriminating power to see yet. But that's, so you're sort of, you're talking about every half a year, or every quarter of a year, or something like that.
Yeah,
that's right. But it's a good point. I think this is the way that the field will progress, that's right. People start to do it. Okay, so now I've been promising that I will explain a completely simple model that gives me this structure for the cross section, and here it is. It's all his fault. It's all Maxime. So imagine that the dark matter is in an SU2 weak triplet. So here is the field content of an SU2 weak triplet, which has zero hypercharge. And I arrange for it to be stable by introducing some parity under which this guy is odd. Then there are some charge states and a neutral state in this triplet. And you can calculate what you expect, naively at tree level, they all have the same mass. But of course, there are loop corrections because the charge guys feel the effects of the photon and the neutral guy doesn't. And you can calculate the splitting that's generated by these loop corrections. And you find that it's about 100 MeV or 150 MeV or so. And unfortunately, for this to work as a model of dark matter, we're going to need it to be around 10 MeV or so, which is requires some small amount of cancellation between this loop correction and some higher dimension operator involving the Higgs. So, but once you have two states, one of which is charged and one of which is neutral, split by around by this amount, you'll see that the interaction of the neutral state, which is the dark matter, with a nucleus is altered, and there is a new resonant channel through which the neutral state can couple to the nucleus. A couple of just parenthetical comments. This charge state is relatively long-lived. It lives sort of a millisecond or so, so that's no problem for cosmology. But of course, would be a long-lived charge state in a collider, and so there are some constraints on this coming from, the strongest ones are coming from the Tevatron, and so roughly speaking, the two states have to be heavier than around about 120 GeV or so. And if you wanted to imagine that this was a thermal relic, so you got the right dark matter abundance just through the thermal history of the universe, it would need to be about 2 GeV in mass. But I'm not going to make that assumption, I'm just going to let the mass float, because there are many ways in which dark matter could have come about. So I'm not going to limit myself to thinking about that. OK, So now there is, in the spectrum of the theory, there is now a nucleus which has a large positive charge. A nucleus can bind up, or maybe it's better to say it the other way around, the negatively charged state can bind up with the nucleus electromagnetically and form a bound state. And so in the, so that there are these bound states existing, and you can work out, just by solving the Schrodinger equation, you can work out exactly what the binding energy of such a system is. I think this table here, I've assumed that the dark matter was 500 GeV. Of course, it all depends on the reduced mass. So once you get above the nucleus mass, it doesn't really change by much. And you see, as you'd expect, that the binding energy depends upon the number of protons there are in your nucleus. So here are the elements in all of the dark matter direct detection experiments. And here are the corresponding binding energies for a massive charge state with that nucleus. And you can see that these binding energies vary over, these are in MeV, vary over a wide range. And so finally, you can imagine the situation where this splitting, this, now you see why I picked 10 MeV as the ballpark number. You can imagine the situation where the splitting sits somewhere in this range, such that if I come in with enough kinetic energy, it's possible for me to upscatter into this bound state, and then for the bound state to fall apart back into its constituents. And so the scattering with the nucleus can take place through a resonant S channel rather than through the usual T channel exchange. And that will change appreciably the way in which you see dark matter at detectors, direct detection detectors. So here is what I mean in what I meant by those words in the picture. So you have one of your dark matter candidates, chi0, comes in and it scatters off the nucleus, and in the process of scattering, it changes into its charge partner. This charge partner can bind up electromagnetically. So notice I haven't introduced any new forces or anything here. I've just introduced one new SU2 state. And it binds up electromagnetically, and then eventually it can fall back apart to the way it, into the pieces it was originally made from. And this is an elastic scatter of the dark matter off the nucleus at the end of the day, but it takes place through a resonance rather than through T-channel. And for this to be, so you can work out exactly what speed you have to come in to hit this resonance. So here's the mass of the resonance. It's just made up of the individual pieces that are in the resonance. There's the charge state, the nucleus mass, there's the binding energy, and then you can imagine this is sort of a keeping track of the fact that you could imagine you don't have to bind up in the ground state of the system. You could be in an excited state of the system. And equally, the nucleus could already be in an excited, could have been in an excited state, or it could be excited in the process of the scattering. So there's two sources for this excitation energy, but I'll just parameterize the whole excitation energy with omega. So this tells you the mass of this bound state. And so the question is this bound state close enough in energy that you have access to it when you do the scattering? And so you can work out what velocity you have to come in at in order to be able to get this bound state, and it's just a simple kinematics, and it's related to the masses of the resonance and the individual components, and that's why delta shows up. Delta is the splitting again between the charged dark matter state and the neutral dark matter state. So that's the crux of it. If there are any questions, you should ask them there. Otherwise, I'll move on. So the idea here is that there we go. So you have, as I said, you have this nucleus, which is a big ball of positive charge, and you have this negative state, this massive negative state, and it can bind up, and you can work out by just solving the Schrodinger equation, taking into account the charge distribution. It's not just a point charge, it's some funny charge distribution inside the nucleus. You can work out what these binding energies are, and that's what I showed you, the binding energy for the ground state on the previous table. And then, of course, there can be excitations of this system where the radius of the orbit changes, and you can have the various bound state excitations, and they're typically of order an MeV or so is the excitation of this system. But equally, there can also be excitations just of the nucleus, and those splittings typically are hundreds of keV as opposed to this, which is sort of thousands of keV. So there are a whole host of states. So the existence of these excited states I parameterized, as I said, by this omega. But there's the potential now that you can have access to one or maybe two or three of these excited states when you do the scatter, because they exist in the spectrum, so you can always scatter through them. And so that's how you end up, you can end up with this S-channel structure for the scattering cross-section. Now, of course, there are a whole load of selection rules you have to take into account. Often you find, if you go and look it up in nuclear tables, that the excited states of nuclei have enormous angular momentum. You know, things you see numbers like 9 halves and things, which to somebody who's used to thinking about fermions and bosons is somewhat daunting. But that means basically you don't have access to that that resonance because of the conservation of angular momentum. We have a fermionic dark matter scattering off a nucleus, which typically starts in its ground state, which has spin of 0 or 1/2 or maybe 3 halves. And so you can't get up to sort of a 7 or 9 half state. But exactly how this band state behaves once it's formed depends upon the details of all the nuclear transitions and other things that can happen. And so I'll try to catalog some of the possible signals in my remaining 20 seconds. Here it is. So this is, I've explained the dynamics by which you can get an S-channel exchange rather than a T-channel exchange. And so you know when you have an S-channel resonance that the cross-section has this structure. This is just your usual non-relativistic resonance scattering formula. But I can rewrite this. I know all these energies and things in terms of the kinetic energy of the incoming state. So I can rewrite this in the experiment, in the lab frame. I can rewrite this expression in terms of velocity. And I get just what I promised you 5 slides ago. I get a scattering cross-section of a nucleus that has this very particular form that will pick out for me a particular range of velocities from the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and ignore the rest of them. And of course, you can easily see that if you take the width of this resonance to be very narrow, this is well approximated by a delta function. And then all your integrals become very straightforward. And these formulae here are just to tell you how to go from one to the other. So can this, so if you take Maxime's model and look at how the neutral state will scatter off the nucleus, you see it has this S-channel form, but can this, in the end of the day, explain Dharma without being in conflict with the other experiments? And that's where this element dependence comes into the game. We saw that the binding energy of the system was very dependent upon the number of protons in the game, which is very dependent on which element you have in your detector. You can arrange a situation where the splitting is such that only certain elements have access to a resonance and all the rest don't. And so their scattering cross-section will be suppressed by the width of the resonance over the position of the resonance, or if you like, delta over VR, and actually goes to the fourth power. Those detectors that don't have an available resonance will have a very suppressed cross-section, and those that do have an available resonance will be able to see something. So you then have to just think about all those detectors which are built from the same material and see if your model is consistent with those. And Dharma, as I said, is made out of, actually it's made out of sodium iodide, but it's really the iodine the dark matter scattering off. But there's another experiment in Korea called KIMS, which is also made out of iodine. And so we have to be very careful that this model wouldn't have shown up at KIMS. So that's what I'll show you on the next transparency. So what we're trying to do here is make sure that we can fit the Dharma spectrum, the modulated and the unmodulated, and not be in conflict with the unmodulated piece. And at the same time, not predict too many events, because KIMS didn't see very many events. For those of you that know, those are the numbers I picked. There's a quench factor that I alluded to earlier in Dharma. I took sort of the average value from the literature, and then there's a quench factor at KIMS that you have to take into account. There's some energy resolution, some smearing, so on and so forth. And for now, I'm just going to imagine that there are 4 parameters that I get to play with, so I'm going to pick 3 of them and then play with the cross-section to get the minimum chi-squared. But of course, in the particular model I just described to you, there's really only 2 free parameters, the mass and the splitting. And so these are related to one another in this very simple SU2 triplet model that I'm describing. But for now, I'll just let them float. And then I'll talk about what happens in the particular model in a second. But you can see, or actually you can't see, because again, projectors washed everything out, that there is, so So the solid line here is the exclusion region from, well, it's this way actually, the exclusion region from the unmodulated Dharma signal. If you were inside this region, you'd predict too many events in, that are not modulated. And this dashed line is a similar thing, but from the Kim's experiment. And then these blue contours are contours of chi squared. So I think this side is 50, no, this side is 15 and above, this is 20 and above in chi squared. And we're trying to fit to, what was it, 12 or 8 bins? I can never remember. 12 bins, they go up to 8 keV. Yeah, okay, sorry, I haven't got to that yet. So there's three parameters. So here I fix the position of the resonant speed. And on this axis I have the dark matter mass. This is 800. This is 100 GeV. And on this axis I have the width. This is 100 kilometers a second. This is zero. Sorry again about the washout. Now on this one, I've done the other thing. I fixed the mass of the dark matter and I varied the other two. And this is, well, I can look at my screen. I can actually read things. This is delta along the vertical and V along the horizontal. So you can see there's plenty of space where you're fitting. You have sort of 15 or fewer, chi squared of 15 for 12 bins, which is not brilliant, but it's not bad. And then these, this dot and this star, I just take two points and I show you the spectrum that I get for the spectrum you'd expect to see at Dharma. So the blue curve is what this model predicts, and the red is, of course, the observed points. This is for the modulated spectrum, and this is the unmodulated spectrum. So these are the particular points I picked in parameter space, here and here. They both have dark matter of 500 GeV, and then they have different places for the resonant speed and different widths. And you can see that you can get a spectrum which does indeed turn over, or a spectrum which will turn over later. So it still is growing, has the usual exponential growth. But in both cases, there still is enough room for the background. There's still, and this is because of the increased modulation.
What is the ratio? What is the modulation?
For these numbers, I don't remember. Probably those correspond to the lines on the previous plot. So it was tens of percent.
Tens of percent.
Tens of percent, yeah, as opposed to whatever the real number is, 3 or 6. I'm off by a factor of 2 in my brain right now. I don't remember if it's 3 or 6. Maybe Maxine knows. Do you remember what a normal wind? So that's that. Oh, and so I should say that, as I said, that if you... I let three out of the four parameters that are listed up there float in these plots. But if, for instance, you take the triplet model, you would actually find that these are exactly in the right ballpark that you'd expect. It's just from electromagnetism being the source of the binding energy. So all I've added is the triplet, and of course I get to change the mass and the splitting of that triplet, but then everything else is determined just by electromagnetism. And those are the numbers. So the cross section works out to be right, and the width works out to be right for this particular point, just from using the triplet model. This one, it's harder to get from the triplet model, but this one you can.
So there's just one free parameter?
Two free parameters, the mass and the splitting. The
splitting isn't determined by...
The splitting has the radiative corrections, but that's too large, so then I need to get rid of some of it with a higher dimension operator, and exactly how much I get rid of is a free parameter.
Well, if you're not going to scale, it doesn't have to be a higher dimension.
That is correct, yeah. Then I did a fermion, but the spin doesn't change anything, other than the fact that you have to explain why it's light.
But a xenon, that's a pretty serious constraint, because it's right, the nuclear is right next to either.
That's right. You can sit down and you can, I'm going backwards, here we go. You can sit down with this table, and you can look at the binding energy, and you also have to take into account the difference in the mass of the nucleus, because when you scatter, you go from xenon into cesium, and they have different masses, because they themselves have different binding energies. And so you need to take that into account. And it's possible, there's a small window where only iodine can see something, but there's also the possibility that if iodine can see it, then xenon can see it. But certainly you see a big difference, say, between germanium and the other, silicon and germanium and the other materials.
I don't quite understand. So if
Adam has which is essentially next around.
Right? Yes, that's right.
Iodine with plus neutral particle goes to xenon charge. Mm-hmm. It has a resonance. Mm-hmm. Then you would expect in cesium this resonance to shift down, right? I mean,
slightly, yes. Yes, you do. Yes, so that's the increase in the binding energy.
Power of states. So but some would shift in, right? So you
that's
could, this is an analysis that is possible. Right.
Yes, so I'm just saying there's the added effect of the fact that the change in going from this element is 0.2 MeV here and it's 0.7 MeV here. So that changes things slightly. And then you have to know exactly what speed the resonance was in iodine, because it could be, say it was at 550, then it may be at 650, or it's higher in...
But it's all calculable.
It's all calculable, I agree. But I'm just saying there's a window where you could arrange that if you just live life on the edge, but only iodine could see it. But as you say, it's more likely that there's also resonances to be seen as xenon.
Is there actually any chance that when it goes into the balance state, it sticks there? And
very good question. I'm glad you asked. So there is, making you dizzy. There's this line here that I didn't explain. This is what's the energy threshold to emit a neutron. So the neutron just falls out of the nucleus. So there's the possibility. So there's a whole host of what can happen here. It's very interesting physics. There's a whole host of ways in which you can interact. So you come in, you scatter through the ground state of the nucleus and the ground state of the BAM system, and then you just fall apart back to the original constituents, back to the original iodine or whatever, and the dark matter. There's the possibility that you are in some excited state, either of the nucleus or of the BAM system, and they de-excite by emitting a photon. There's a possibility that they do that, and two happens, and then one happens. Of course, you would fall apart to a slower-moving dark matter than you were before. There's also the possibility that you emit a neutron. So this is like two, except rather than emitting a photon, you emit a neutron if you happen to be in a sufficiently excited state. And then if four happens, then you would have... It turns out the energy the neutron carries away is so much that you're bound forever. You're too deeply bound now. You can't fall back apart into the original things. And so then this is a correlated signal you can look for. If this is, of course, doesn't just happen in dark matter direct detection experiments. It would happen anywhere. And there are, Earth has been around for a long time, and dark matter presumably has been running into the Earth for a long time. So you can go out and look for heavy elements, anomalously heavy isotopes. But because this binding energy scales with Z, you need to go look at large Z, high Z materials. And most of these searches for anomalously heavy elements have been done on seawater, which isn't very high Z. But there are some experiments that are being done looking at gold and iron. And so there are constraints on the fraction of anomalously heavy isotopes you can have of gold and iron. It's about 10 to minus 10. And if you sit down and work it out, you get something you'd expect, say 10 to the minus 12 from this. So you're on the edge. I mean, these can be... These can be done again, they can be improved. I mean, it's just a mass spectrometer and they're just pumping a whole lot of atoms through. And these were done a fair time ago, a decade or more ago, so they can be, certainly you'd hope that this might be within reach.
Is this still an active research program? Because there's always these things popping up, these heavy isotopes.
I remember the paper being about a decade or so old, and I didn't find anything more recent than that on the experimental side. So I don't know what that means, whether it's active or not. Maybe it means that it takes a long time to do the experiment. This is certainly something that could be done, and this would also tell you at the end of the day what material you should build your detector from. Right, if you did find enormously heavy elements. And these are all these searches, they do gold and iron because they've been sitting around for a long time, and they were motivated by, I think, stable colored states. And so they don't have very big penetration. If they do come in from outside, they don't get very far through the Earth. So you have to find stuff that's sitting on the surface, that's been around on the surface for a long period of time. But dark matter doesn't have that problem, right? It doesn't really interact at all, which is part of the problem. So, these can be adapted. You don't have quite the same restrictions. Okay, sorry for running over. Here are my conclusions. As I said, there are many possible dark matter candidates, and it's a good time, and I'm glad we are, as a field, looking at a very non-standard dark matter candidates rather than just your SUSY neutralino. because there are a whole host of experiments out there that are probing and are about to probe the way in which these dark matter particles can couple to the standard model. And so it's good to try and explore all the phenomenological possibilities, all the different signatures. So RDM is one of those. It has some fairly unique features that distinguishes it from some of the other non-standard dark matter models. Here are some of them listed here. There are some sort of interesting signatures. You can look for these photon lines. So if it was an excited nucleus, it could de-excite by emitting a photon. That would be in a line, not just it wouldn't just be a continuum. There's also these heavy element experiments you could do to look for it. And of course, as we said, there are one of the experiments that's in the pipeline and should be releasing data, say, within the calendar year, is Xenon 100. And that will have a lot to say about this model and many others. So it'll be an exciting time. Keep reading your New York Times. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes.
So the velocity that you used for the resonance, what was it? It was 700 something?
It was, one of them was 700 or so, that's right.
Isn't that larger than the escape velocity?
It's larger than the escape velocity in the galactic frame. But the escape velocity in the Earth's frame is that plus the Earth's speed. So, and the escape velocity I took was 500, so 200. So it's just inside. It's right on the edge. But it depends exactly.
Do you truncate the? It's right there, right in there.
Yeah, it's
so
just.
You do truncate the Boltzmann distribution, or that doesn't matter if you
truncate. There's sort of two approaches. I don't know which is correct. I can make arguments for both of them. That you take the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and you stop it at some point,
yeah.
And so there's a cliff. Or you take the Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and shift it in such a way that it goes to zero at the escape velocity. And I can make intuitive arguments for why both approaches. And so I don't, at the end of the day, something like this, if you're right on the edge, is sensitive to it. But of course, if you're say, if that edge is 750 and I have a 720 and it's relatively narrow, then I don't care exactly how you cut it off. Now, this is unlike inelastic, which is very, very sensitive to how exactly you cut off the Maxwell-Boltzmann.
What's the intuitive argument for being a cliff? I
can
see the other one.
Well, you could just imagine that you had a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution and stuff is just boiling off, right? There are things that are beyond the escape velocity inside the cloud, but they're just passing through. So, if you had a lump of stuff and then this stuff, I don't see why it has to go to zero at that point. I mean, you can't have things at the escape velocity. So... You don't expect very many of them, but I don't know exactly how it turns off. I mean, it isn't even a Maxwell-Boltzmann, right? There are these Via Lactea simulations that show it's not a Maxwell-Boltzmann. Now, whether you should trust those, I don't know. So if you can, I see no reason to favor one over the other, because at the end of the day, they are just essentially parameterizations of the unknowns. Oh no, we didn't. No, so there's a whole variety you could do. I mean, we were trying to be as minimal as possible and not introduce any new forces. But if you wanted to, it doesn't have to be electromagnetism that binds them together. You'd have to play a lot more games though, because there's not really much of a charge that a nucleus carries. It could be B minus L or something. So you could play games like that. But this seemed to be the minimal thing you could do without it.
Any more questions? All right, let's thank her again.
So I actually think your question has a